I'm Joby. I'm definitely an alcoholic. I'm looking at my watch. We should have time to dance for about 10 minutes. I just want to say, I was talking to Cindy a little while ago while we were eating dinner, and I don't know what I'm doing here. You know, I stop and I've been thinking about this on the drive down. Madison's just about 5 miles west of Huntsville. And I was thinking on the drive down, as I've been thinking pretty much for the whole year, 52 years this group has been together. And I can't, with sufficient words, say how grateful I am for you all who have paved the road so that I could stand here tonight and share a little bit about myself. Because if you've never thought about it, but you stop and think about 52 years back, there was two drunks, maybe three. I don't know what the heritage is or what the story is, but would we, any one of us, be sitting here if that never happened? And I think I'd like to personally give a little bit of a round of applause for those people who aren't here right now but who made it possible for us, because I don't know where I'd be without you. And I also want to say, Cindy, thank you for having me here. I really am grateful for that. Well, you could probably tell by looking at me that I'm not really from Huntsville. I am from Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is a little town of about 50,000 people north of El Paso, Texas. I moved to Huntsville back in 1990, and have loved it ever since. And to me, this is home. And I've been dying to say this, because when I got here, we won national championships. So let me say, roll tide, baby, roll. I don't care. Yeah, we'll struggle. We'll struggle, but that's okay. We'll be back. I'm from Las Cruces, New Mexico, and born and raised, generations and generations, they tell me. And I don't know where it started, and I'm not going to pretend. I used to get up here and say, oh, it was this, you know, but that's probably my ego. I want to say that, too. Let me put this little qualifier in there that I'm about as big an egomaniac as you'll ever meet. I pretty much think I invented everything. I pretty much know that if you saw things the way I do, you know, you'd surely be right, and your life would be in order. Yeah, and that's why I'm standing up here. Anyway, I started drinking. Well, let me backtrack a little bit from there. When I was growing up, my family, you know, we had the big fiestas, the big pig roasts, you know, the dig a hole and everybody comes over, and we're going to have this big birthday party on Saturday. But they'd start on Thursday, of course. You know, got to get going, got to get primed up a little bit. And so they'd come by, and everybody'd start coming and building a fire and talking to the pig and kind of. And I was a little kid, and I'd be walking around, and I'd be just in awe of this big thing, this big deal that was going to happen on the weekend. You know, thinking, all right, you know, this is partying, you know, and I'd want to be like the big man over there. And of course, they'd have a keg, and they'd tap that beer, and they'd pass it around. Somebody break a bottle out, and they'd start passing that bottle around. But I noticed something that always happened. You know, there was always this real happy, joyous kind of start. And then that bottle got passed around, and I always noticed that the noise level seemed to escalate a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more, higher and higher and higher. And somebody always have to have a little bit more of a point to make. And always have to make sure you understood. Don't you understand? And then the next thing I know is that, you know, somebody's laying there on the floor with a broken nose. And from what I understood, that was communication and that was partying. But I didn't know. All I knew is that I didn't want to be like that. Because, you see, as they would get that uproar, as that noise level would get up, something inside of me would start churning. And it wouldn't feel right. And I would think, this isn't right. And I'd be scared, and that fear would overwhelm me, and I would kind of withdraw. And I'd watch these people, and it'd be this big old brawl before you know it, and Saturday's party wasn't as big a party as it was supposed to be. Well, I knew that from watching that sort of thing that I didn't want to be like that. I knew that something inside of me was not right, and that if you knew that about me, what would you think? And I'm talking about, I was 6 and 7 years old. You know, I was just this little kid, and I'd see people, but I'd feel really ashamed and didn't even know that was the word. Didn't know what that was. And my mom and dad, and I'd watch my dad go out, and he'd go out and drink. And before I go any farther, I want to say this, because this is important to me. You know, the more you do these talks, you hear your tape, and you say, oh, my God, you know, I sound like I'm blaming my dad. I'm not here to blame anybody for the way I am today. It's not their fault. Nobody poured whiskey down my throat. I did it myself. But what I saw, now this is my other side, is that through my perception, what I saw was that I saw this violent, angry man coming home and beating up mom and tearing the household apart. And if he wasn't going to beat her, he was going to beat me. And I swore as a small child, I remember thinking to myself, I'm never going to be like that. I'm not going to be that violent, angry person. I'm not going to be so full of that bitter anger. Well, I'd watch that go on for a little while, and that thing inside of me just kept growing. Kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. More fear, more guilt, more shame. Didn't know why, but it was there. And one night, my cousin and I, we were about 10 or 11 years old. I don't remember how old we were, but we had gone and we had stolen a bunch of beer from my grandpa's refrigerator. And we took it out into the cotton field. And I remember it like it was yesterday, sitting again that row of cotton, popping that top, thinking to myself, I don't even like this taste. I remember taking sips of grandpa and my dad's beers, you know, but that, so I remember pinching my nose, you know, and pouring it back as fast as I could. And I remember burning my throat. And I was like, oh, my God. But at 11 years old, I wasn't drinking for the taste of that alcohol. I was drinking for what was going to happen and what I saw happen along with everyone in my family when they had that big party. I was looking for something that was going to take me away, and it did. I remember it burned, and I looked at my cousin, and his eyes were red, and my eyes were red, and I could feel him burning, and I tipped it back again, and I poured it all down. And that's the way I drank. I don't ever remember drinking any alcohol to the day I quit because I liked the taste of it. I drank it every single time for the effect it was going to give me. Every single time. And I drank it that time. I poured it down my throat. And I poured another one down my throat. And I poured another one down my throat. And at that time, I used to play little peewee football. And that was on a Friday night. And that next Saturday morning, I missed my first football game. I didn't know that I was really setting a pattern. I didn't know that what I was doing was setting up the way the rest of my life was going to go. Or not the rest of my life, but a good portion of how it was going to be. Well, needless to say, I didn't drink every day. Pretty hard when you're 11 years old. But what did happen was that something inside of me was changed. Something inside of me knew that there was an answer. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor showed me a page in the doctor's opinion, and he said, Joe, look here. He said, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. To them, the sensation is so elusive that they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. He said, when you drank that, and that altered perception changed in you, you were no longer able to differentiate true from false. And you took that true from false, and you started making a reality out of things that weren't real. You started making things mountains out of molehills over here. You started making things just unreal. And I, well, sure. Yeah, I couldn't stop my leg from shaking, and this guy's telling me, you know, you got a perception problem. I'm thinking, wait, man, I can't even. But I remember that now, and that's what's important. Anyway, long story short is that I didn't drink every day, but I knew that there was an answer. Well, I went on into high school and started smoking dope somewhere in there as well. So let me say that I am one of those drug users as well. I use drugs, but I am alcoholic all the way through my bones. I know that because alcohol is what I use to get away from me. Any narcotic, anything that I ever used made me more aware of myself. And hell, I didn't need to be more aware of me. You know? I was looking for the other side. I was looking for getting away. So we started playing around with that sort of stuff. But what I played football all through from that little Mighty Mite time all the way up until I was a senior in high school. And I played football, and I used to think it was because it made me the macho man. I was a big guy on campus. Man, look at how bad I am, you know. And it wasn't until a few years sober, really, and a couple of four steps that I realized that I looked back and saw something totally different. You see, if you knew what I was really like, if you could see me down inside, if you could really, really look down into my soul, you wouldn't like me anymore. And I couldn't take that chance. I couldn't take the chance of you not appreciating how great a person I was. See, I see through this perception thing that I have, I see that everybody functions at a level, normal level playing field. Everybody plays right here. But I'm down here. And if you knew I was down here, what would you think of me? So in order to see myself at this level, I had to perform at this level. So I was a football player who absolutely never left the field. I played offense, I played defense, I played punt return, kickoff return. I never left the field. I was the macho man. No, what I was is I was afraid. And so I'd go out and make an idiot of myself sometimes, you know. And I would do that because I thought, how could I get a date? She'd never go out with me. The only thing, you know, I've got to build myself up so that she could see all the letters that I wear. I've got to make myself look so good because if she really knew where I came from, if she knew that I watched my dad beat my mom every night, if she knew that my dad beat me if he wasn't beating my mom, what would she think? So I had to masquerade it. Now, that was what I did with my actions. That was the doing thing. But when I drank alcohol, it instantly took me to that spot. I no longer had to work that hard. You see, and in my mind, it became me. It became what I was. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. Well, that was me. You see, I had no power, and so I had to make everything look like it on the outside. Well, I went through high school, and I graduated basically because I took all my football coaches for my teachers. When I got sober and I went back to school, I had to take all the, you know, math 0000 all over again. And I had to go back to the English, and I had to really just literally go through school all over again because I knew nothing. I really knew nothing like I thought I did. But you see, I could tell you I did. Well, I got out of high school and graduated, and a friend of mine was going to a fraternity party. And he called me up. He said, "Hey, man, we're going to this big rush party over on campus." And I said, "Oh, yeah, cool, let's go." So we went, and there was this party. And we walked through these gates and walked into this backyard of this frat house. And in the backyard of this frat house, they had a semi-truck. And this semi-truck had beer spigots sticking out all the way down the side. It was tapped. There were 100 kegs of beer in that thing. And I got there, and I'm from southern New Mexico, and it was in the summer. It was about this time of year, and the girls were wearing such short shorts. They were wearing just, oh, my God. I looked around in there, and I thought, hallelujah, man. I have arrived. Now, where have these people been all my life? I wish I would have known this all along, you know, and I just was looking around. And so I joined the fraternity that night. I joined that fraternity and went home. Now, I've got to backtrack a little bit here, too, because, you see, my mom was 15 years old when she had me. She had four kids by the time she was 25, and that whole time I watched my dad abuse her. She divorced my dad when my little sister was probably 3 or 4 weeks old, maybe a little bit older, but needless to say, very, very young. So she was a single mother raising four children, trying to do the best she can. Obviously, no education. Support to my dad meant once you know, every 3 or 4 months we'd go to McDonald's or something. So I went home that night from the fraternity, or the next day, waking up with a hangover, I walk in with great news from my mom. Mom, guess what? She said, well, what? You know, like, oh my God, where are we going now? I'm going to college, I told her. And she just about fell out. She's like, going to college? I said, yeah, I'm going to college. She said, well, how did that come about? And I said, well, you know, all my friends are going, and I know that if I'm going to make it anywhere in my life, you know, I'm going to have to go to college. And she said, well, if you'll go, I'll help you pay the tuition. We'll do whatever we can, but I'll help you. Now, see, I told my mom that that's what I wanted to do, to get somewhere in life. Mom, I had to have an education. My friends were going. But what I didn't tell her was, last night I joined the frat, you know, and they have 100 kegs of beer. I bet you they still got some, you know. I could hardly wait to get out the house that day. I didn't tell her about all the girls that were there that came from all over the country. You know, they were everywhere. Well, I joined the fraternity, and I guess it was a couple weeks later, they came to me and they said, Joe, you know, we're gonna have to talk. And I said, sure, man, you know, whatever, you know, hey, brothers, man, you know, that's us. Me and you, you know, all the way. And so they sat me down and they said, you know, Joe, we love you being here. You're a model, you know. Yeah, I was a John Belushi model is what I was. And they said, you're what we want in this fraternity, but you're going to have to register for school. You know, it's like, you can't just be in the fraternity and not be in school. Well, yeah, I'm going to, I told them. I'm just kind of trying to put some money together. You know, I don't know what I'm going to take. So I ended up taking a few classes, and needless to say, the end of that semester, I was on academic probation. The next semester, I was kicked out, and there I was all by myself, a little bit closer to what you see me like, really, down here. Well, being the great rebounder that I am, I said, you know what, I'll make it. I know I'll make it. And at that time, I was like the chief person in charge of washing dishes or something like that. But to me, I was the assistant manager, you know. Well, they gave me an opportunity to really become an assistant manager, but I had to move about 350 miles away to a little town called Clovis, New Mexico. It's over on the eastern side, right next to Texas, about 3 miles away from Texas. And I say this every time I talk, but it bears saying, if you've never been there, don't. it's flat. It is just flat dust. I mean, rabbits run in front of trucks and stuff out there. You know, it is just, it's flat, nothing out there. Well, I got there, and I walked into the restaurant, and the manager was talking to this young lady. And he was talking to her, and she was starting work the next day. So I walked in. He said, oh, it's good to see you. Come on in, you know, this is so-and-so, and, you know, she's starting tomorrow, and I hear that you have a lot of background in being a waiter, you know, so one of the things that we'll do is you'll help train her. So I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I needed somebody. I needed somebody bad. I'm now 350 miles away from all those frat brothers and all those people I grew up with and everybody that I used to party with. I didn't know this at that time, but we talked. And she smiled, and I smiled back, and that night, she spent the night with me. And the next day, I was her boss. Well, long story short is, 6 months later, we were married. See, I don't have relationships. I take hostages. You know, I don't just kind of just bring you in my life. I hold you forever. You know, as long as you do what I want you to do. Now, so in that 6 months' time, I was transferred back to El Paso. And I got back to El Paso. Now, El Paso is only 30 miles south of my hometown. And all my buddies are back there. Hey, all those girls are back there. Hey, I may not be in the frat, but I know how they do it now, you know? So while I had moved back, she was following me, and she was still a month behind. So by the time she got down to El Paso, she was not necessary. You know, it was like, oh, my God, this is a real crimp in my style. So I would go out as if she wasn't there. You know, it's like, you're just an interference, and so I'll just go party anyway. Well, I would go out, and I would roll in about 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, spend all our money again. And she'd say, you know, oh, who were you? Where were you? Where you been? You weren't like this before. And I'd get in her face and I'd say, but you know, just leave me alone. I've got to have my space now. Why'd you come down here? And I'd get in her face and then I'd make up with her and then I'd get in her face and then. What I didn't recognize at that time was exactly what I remembered when I was growing up. My dad rolling in about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and my mom asking him, where you been? Where you been? And him telling her, well, what's it to you? What's it to you? And the screaming and the yelling got higher and higher and higher. And then there was the punches that came all behind that. Well, you know, I remember that, but I didn't think that that was applying to me at that time. She was more of a hindrance to me. And I don't need her in my life right now. She's just a hindrance. Well, I lost my job and had to move back home or back up to Las Cruces, and I moved in with my mom, and she came with me by that time we were married. And that really put a cramp in my freedom. I mean, now I've got my mom to deal with. I've got a wife to deal with. What in the world is going on? Well, my wife at that time, finally said, I can't do this anymore. And she packed up her stuff, and she moved back to Clovis. And now all of a sudden, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, she can't leave me. How could she leave me of all people? I am so good for her. I mean, I am like everything this girl could have ever even dreamed of having. So I packed up my stuff, and I followed her over there. I was living in a little tiny trailer at the time, and she was living with her mom. Now, she didn't know I was back in Clovis. And I knew that she went back to the place that she was working at before, and so I'd go over and I'd kind of, you know, try to get back with her. From about 3 blocks away, I'd sit there and I'd watch her. I'd watch her and I'd sit there and I'd drink and I'd watch her in that at the restaurant that she worked at. Then I'd watch her come out to her car and I'd follow her home, you know, and then she'd pull in and I'd kiss her goodnight from about 3 blocks away. And then she'd go in and I'd go back to the little trailer. And then just get rip-roaring drunk. Well, one night, she took a detour. And she took this detour and went over to a friend's house. A friend that I knew she had. And so I followed her over and I'm watching. And there's a bunch of cars out there, so they're obviously having a party. And I followed her and I parked down the street and I kind of crept over there, you know, commando style. And I'm looking through the window, through the bushes, and they're sitting there playing drinking games, you know, and there's this guy flirting with my wife, and she's still my wife. So I'm sitting there watching that. Inside of me, I'm thinking, who do you think you are? Barging in on my territory like that. Who do you think you are to just come right in, you know? And so all this stuff, so I decided that it would be very, very good for me to go in there and communicate with them. Just the same way my family always used to communicate. So I would go in, or I went in, and I said, what the hell's going on? And it started at that yelling level, and the yelling got louder, and it got louder. And her friend ran over in front of me and said, Joe, just leave us alone. And I picked her up, and I threw her against the wall. And she fell down and her arm was broken. Her boyfriend gets up and I hit him and I dropped him to the ground. And then that guy gets up. Huh. That guy should have never got up. I saw what he was doing to my wife, talking to her. You know? And so I hit him. And then she got up and she was crying and she said, "Oh my God, please, why? Just leave me alone, leave me alone." And she started screaming, "I'm telling you, you don't understand, I love you. Please don't leave me," you know, and I'm screaming and yelling and she's saying, get away. And I picked her up and I threw her and she fell down to the ground and she fell into a little ball. Sitting there, wadded up, crying, saying, "Why me? What have I done to deserve this? Why? What? Can't you just leave me alone?" And I sat there, and what I saw was my wife, but what I saw was my mom. And what I remembered was how inside of me I said, I would never be that. I was never going to be like that. Never. Ever was I going to. I could not. How could anybody be like that? No, I became everything I said and swore I'd never be. Never going to do that. And I walked out of there. And the next morning, a sheriff came over to my house, and he was knocking on my door, and I walked out, really hungover, and he said, "I've got 4 warrants for you, boy." He said, "And I'll tell you what, if you're not here when I get back, I'll lose the paperwork." "Oh, I can't. You don't understand," I told him. "I've got to fix everything I did last night, you know." And I don't know if you guys are alcoholic like me, but I have this thinking problem. I have this thing that says if I just fix things right, if I just get everything in order, if I can just straighten all this mess out, I'll be happy and things will be all right and we'll be all good. Is he not the victim of the delusion that he can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if only he manages well? Well, that was me. If I just manage, so I'm telling this little short, fat sheriff with a cigar in his mouth, staring at me, telling me, "You got to get out of town." "Oh, I can't do that, man. I got a lot of problems I got to work out." You know, and he's like, "You're not hearing me. Got 4 assault charges on you, and if you're not out of here by the time I get back, I'm taking you to jail." "Ah, now I hear what you're saying." So I told him, I packed up my car and my little dog, and we headed back to Las Cruces. About 350 miles. Like I said, it's out there in the middle of the desert. In between Roswell, New Mexico, where the UFOs are, and I think I've seen a few of them, and Clovis is 100 miles exactly. Straight road, flat, nothing. At the 50-mile marker of that road is a bar. The Oasis Bar. Boy, I could see that forever. So I pulled in there, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank. Because all I could think about all the way home, or all the way back to Las Cruces, was, how am I going to get this squared? How am I going to get this fixed? What am I going to do? What if she's with that guy? And all these things going on in my head. Thinking. I mean, I love Alcoholics Anonymous with all of my heart. I am a diehard Alcoholics Anonymous member. There is not a piece of printed material I don't agree with except that little think thing. I don't know where the hell that came from. Because for me, that don't work well. Now, I understand the think the drink through, okay? I can understand that, but the think is not good for me. I have this, like, things that go on, and I can fix things, you know, and man, when I fix things, it just turns into mud. Anyway, so I got back, and I contacted her, and she was going through with the divorce. I got papers, and all I could do was just about want to drink myself to death. I got back, I got a job, I was living with my mom, and went into this, you know, self-imposed depression, and just drank. And one night, my dog and I were sitting on the bank of the Rio Grande and watching one of those brilliant New Mexico sunsets. And I cried out to God, and I said, "God, I can't go on like this. I don't know what's going on." And the next morning, I still don't know how this happened. I've tried to replay this in my head, but it's really not important. But the next morning, I ended up in treatment. I ended up in a treatment center in El Paso that was one of these resorts. You know, it was like, to pass our time today, we're going to make the little belts. You know, what do you see when you do the belt? you know, oh, I can see how much my love for her is coming out on the belt, you know. What? And then we go to music therapy, you know. And then I go to music therapy and they tell me, pick out a song, you know, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, because you know she's sitting over there crying somewhere, you know. Oh, yeah, deep, you know, deep, Joe. And I'm like, yeah, you know. And at that time, that was the first time I had ever seen Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I went in there, and they had the steps on the wall. I read them and became the model student. Now, I want to say this because it's very important to me. I wanted to stop living the way I was living. I didn't know that that was alcoholism. I didn't know what I had grown up with was this alcoholism. I didn't know what all that stuff was defined. Now, they laid it out there for me, and being the intellect that I am, you know, I caught on to it real quick. Powerless over alcohol, man, that's me. You know, every time I drink, I'm a lunatic. Unmanageable, I owe everybody. You know, I can't keep a job. It's this and that. I am unmanageable. Believe in God, I already believe in God. Insane, well, yeah, we'll deal with that one later. Turn it over, yeah. May direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. The loophole, that's how I'll get her back, right there. I'll be, because now I got the steps. So when I got out of treatment, I went on this crusade. I'm going around all of New Mexico to all my family and telling them how sorry I was. And they'd sit there and kind of like, God, where's this guy coming from? You know. Well, I didn't have a sponsor. All I did was read these things and I, you know, made little belts. That trip ended in Clovis on September 26th, as a matter of fact. And that was 1 year and 3 hours later, our divorce day. I mean, our anniversary to the date. I was divorced on my anniversary. So 1 hour and 3 hours later, we were divorced. Now, I got there, and I hadn't seen her since April. And she was 6 months pregnant. And I told her, we went in, and the judge said, you know, sir, do you have representation? Don't need it. Sober. You know, I have God now. And everything's going to be great, you know. He said, well, do you understand you're relinquishing parental rights to this child? Technicality, we'll be back together shortly, I know it. And signed the paperwork, walked out, went to the truck, came back, handed her a dozen roses and said, I'm sorry for all the things I've done to you, and I know because I'm an alcoholic, we're going to get back together and things are going to be great. And she looked at me and she said, Joe, I won't use the word she said, but she said, never, ever will you see me again or this child. Never. And I could tell she meant it. So I got back in the truck, 50 miles down the road was the Oasis Bar. Stopped in there, got back, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I just went on this crusade. Told everybody I was a drunk and an alcoholic, and now I'm drinking again. You know, so I put the plug in the jug and started going to meetings. But I started going to meetings with a little bit of a different attitude. My attitude was, I'm 21 years old, 22 years old. My wife left me. Poor me. Poor me. These steps, I worked them. I worked them all. You know, went out, told everybody how sorry I was. And just not working. Just not working. So obviously it was wasn't very long. I went and I, you know, put a little end to this little myth. They say that you won't get drunk if you go to a meeting. Well, I left the meeting and got drunk. Rolled my car 5:30 that morning. So meetings don't keep you sober. I rolled my car 5:30 that morning and I was a mess. You know, I figured, oh, what the hell. I'll just drink and die. Now, I believe that there are two surrenders in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I believe that you can surrender to recovery, and when you surrender to recovery, you turn your life and will over to the care of God as you understand it, just as the steps say. But you can also surrender to alcohol. And I don't mean surrender to alcohol by surrendering to alcohol, I'm never going to drink again. I surrendered to alcohol and said, alcohol, you are now my master, and I'll do whatever it takes to get you. I'll do whatever it takes to find you. Now, of course, I didn't say that in my conscious mind, but I figured, why? Why should she's not coming back? Everything I do, I turn to mud. Everybody I touch, I hurt. I steal from my family. You know, I grew up to be everything I said I was never going to be. And time moved on, and I went to a bar, and this little girl came up and said, hey, do you dance? I said, yeah, sure. The short version is that about 2 years later, with that little girl, was the exact same scenario as what had happened with the first one. She woke up one morning and had a black eye. And I'm asking her, what happened to you? What happened? And she said, nothing, nothing. And somebody later called me and told me, how is she doing? What do you mean? Oh, man, you beat the hell out of her last night. I was like, no way. Yeah. And I thought, oh, not again. And she left, 6 months pregnant. I've not seen, for my first wife, I've never seen my little boy. She had a little boy in December, and I've never seen him to this day. Don't know where they're at. It's the only amends on my list I've not made. The second relationship I was in, he had a little girl. There was a difference in this relationship, though, for me. And the difference is that I absolutely knew that if I kept on going the way I was going, that I would lose her completely. Now, she stuck with me even through that incident. And I decided that I needed to go to treatment again. First one didn't take so well, so I needed to go to another one. The first one was this luxury resort. Now I had no job, and I ended up in a state hospital. And so I'm sitting in the state hospital at Fort Baird, New Mexico, Silver City, way up in the mountains. Beautiful, beautiful place. And I'm sitting there thinking again. If I can just come up with enough money to get my license back, if I could just pay the rent, if I could just get all these things squared up, things will be all right. I already know what to do because I've been in AA once. So I made a phone call, and I called up this girl, and I said, hey, you know, I've been thinking a little bit. She said, yeah, what's the matter? And I said, I've already been in treatment, and I know that I need to go to AA. And so I'm going to go to AA, and it's not going to be that way again, and I'm never going to hurt you. I love you, and I'm crying on the phone telling her how important she is. And she said, okay, I believe you. You know, you didn't have to go in the first place. And I said, well, will you come pick me up? And I'd only been there about 3 or 4 days, 5 days, I guess. She said, sure. So she was there that afternoon. But before she hung up, I said, hey. She said, yeah. I said, bring that pot with you, okay? She said, oh, yeah, no problem. So I was smoking a joint, driving off from that place. Well, she was pregnant, and of course I did exactly the same thing. It was no time before I was drunk again. And I went to treatment again. And this time she wasn't coming back. She was pregnant. She was 9 months pregnant at the time. August 24th, my daughter was born. As a matter of fact, just 5 days ago. 12 years ago. You know, almost to the day. And I was in treatment at that time. And they called me and said, it's a little girl, you know, da-da-da-da. So I left the treatment center. It happened to coincide with the last day of my treatment. So I went down, and I went straight to the hospital, and she said, no, you can't see her. You can't see her. I don't want you around her. And I said, look, I've already lost a little boy, and I'm not going to go through this again. Whether you're going to be a part of it or not, I'm going to stay sober because I'm going to be a father to that child. And she saw that I really meant business, and I had been in treatment now, and I was sober, and I wasn't going to do it again. Well, we started to kind of try to patch things up real slowly. It was real slow. And somewhere around October, November, a couple months after treatment, she came over, and we were out, and she said, you know, you're not so bad. You know, when you drink alcohol, you're a lunatic. Man, you're a wild man. God only, you're like a crazy Indian. Matter of fact, she used to call me the crazy Indian. You know, and I'd say, yeah, I know, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol. She said, but when you smoke pot, you're not that bad. Ah, thanks, higher power, man. That's what I needed to hear. Now, all this time, I had been taking Anabuse because I knew that if I drank again, I would be in the same situation all over again. And about Christmas time, now what I had become was I was going to meetings here and there, getting high before I went or right after, you know, steps were working, things are cool. God, the baby cries in the middle of the night. I'm trying to buy diapers on a minimum wage job. I'm just, stuff was all over me. And I was trying to be sober. You know, don't you understand? I'm sober now. And on Christmas Eve, I sat at this Christmas tree, and they were supposed to come over, and I bought a little dress for my little girl and something for her, and they never showed up. And I've never seen them again since. Well, I have since had one opportunity to meet my daughter. Just a couple years ago, but I'll get to that later. So I sat there saying, it doesn't work, you see? It doesn't work. I've been going to meetings. Yeah, smoking. Papa, what does that have to do with it, you know? It just doesn't work. And so I promise you this is honest to God truth. I rationalized. I've been taking Anabuse for about 3 or 4 months. And I rationalized in my head that one drink wouldn't hurt. So I went out on, this was on New Year's Eve, and I had a 64-ounce Thirst Buster. I put ice in it, I poured a fifth of Tanqueray in there, splashed it with some tonic, squeezed the lime, and rationalized to myself that this one drink on Anabuse won't hurt. Now, so I started sipping like I sipped that first one, tipping it back and drinking for the effect, because that's all I wanted was to get out of me. I couldn't handle it inside anymore. I couldn't deal with what was happening in here anymore. I could not just face this life. So I slammed that drink down. And now, I don't know if any of you alcoholics have ever had the opportunity to do acid or eat mushrooms or anything like that, but that's what initial feeling feels like when you drink Anabuse, when you drink on Anabuse. My hands started, like, electric shocks were going through them. I was like, damn. Then I noticed these red marks started popping out all over me. Just red blotches, like mega hives. You haven't ever had hives like this. And I'm watching myself break up, and all of a sudden, oh my God, my stomach just felt like somebody took a bar and smashed me across the middle. And I started puking, and I had fluids and things coming out from places I don't even know where they came from. I laid curled up in the hallway of a friend's house and thought I was just going to die. Really, to be honest with you, I wish I would have. My heart was just pounding out of my chest. I thought I was going to die. So I said, after that experience, that thankfully I lived through it, I said, I am never going to do that again. So I quit taking Anabuse. Gave it about 5 days and surrendered to alcohol like I had never surrendered before. And I started drinking, and I just wanted to drink to die. Drink to die, that's all. My mom told me somewhere in that point, in that period, January 1987, she said, I can't watch you die. I love you with all of my heart, and I would do anything, absolutely anything for you, Joe, but I can't watch you kill yourself. Don't come back. I used to say she kicked me out and all that, but I mean, you know, she was doing what she had to do. My brother and sisters were there, and in that time, now growing up, being that my mom had divorced my dad when I was 10 years old, my grandpa was pretty much my hero. He raised me, taught me to hunt, fish. He was a He was a home builder, taught me everything there is, every trade there is to know about home building. And one night I went over, somewhere in February or so, I had gone over there, and I just was tired. I don't know if you guys were like that, but you just get to a point where you just get tired, man. It's just like, all I want to do is just like, just let me step off for just a couple minutes, catch my breath, and things will be all right. I went over there, hadn't been drinking, my grandpa had. And I asked my grandma, can I just take a shower and maybe get something to eat and stay the night? She said, oh, yes, and of course you can. And so I went in, my grandpa was watching the game, and I went over to talk to him and just to sit down and visit. So he starts telling me everything that's wrong with me. He said, oh, it's this, you did that. You know, and I was like, oh, man, no, it's not you too, you know? I don't need somebody else. I said, look, I'll tell you what, I'm just going to leave. And I got up, and he got up, and we bumped into each other, and his communication skills went into effect. Said, look, you want a part of me, man? Come on, let's go outside. I'll show you, man. I'll show you what a real man is. I'm saying, man, grandpa, you're my grandfather, man. You know, and I'm built like I am right now. And he's like, oh, we'll just go outside. And I said, well, when we went outside, I wasn't going to fight him. I was trying to leave. My grandma comes out. My mother lived right across the street. She comes over there. What's going on? There's all this screaming and yelling going on. And my grandpa throws my grandmother to the ground. He hits my mother. And I just went off. I just went off. I wasn't beating my grandpa because he hit my mom, but something inside of me just said, get this crap out. And I beat my grandpa to the point where I almost killed him. Both of his eyes were completely shut. I broke his ribs on both sides. I kicked him down a dirt road, and I kicked him, and I kicked him, and I kicked him. And I left. My God, the only human being I have a shred of respect for is God. I've even puked all over that. And I wanted to die. All I could do was go into a bar and steal every drink I could possibly get my hands on, steal maybe 10, 15 bucks, go down to Old Mexico, get me a bottle of tequila and some Corona, and come back and just try to die. But I couldn't. And one night, I'd called my mom, had stolen a bunch of money from a friend of mine on a drug deal, and was in a hotel room and had all kinds of stuff there to get out of myself. The more I drank, the more sober I got. It seemed like for every drink I drank, the more real life got. My best friend wasn't working anymore. So I called my mom and said, I can't go on. I'm going to die. I want to die. And she was crying, no, don't do anything dumb. No, we'll come help you. We'll take you to treatment. No, I don't want to try treatment anymore. No more treatment. Just stop. Why? Work the steps? What are they going to do? And that morning, I watched them drive off to work because this hotel was right across the street from them. And I went over, I took one of my dad's guns, I went back to the motel room on March the 17th of 1987 and put that gun in my mouth. And I wanted to die. And then, in that first treatment center, I remember Miss Patty saying, jails, institutions, and death, that's where people like you end up, Joe. And I realized, yeah, I'd been in jail all over the place, and I'd been in institutions. But what I realized, what she was talking about, wasn't the death about being hit in the head with a pool cue, because I'd been hit in the head with a pool cue. It wasn't about being beaten up in some bar room. It wasn't about running into 100 miles an hour into an oak tree. It was about the death I was living. It was about the death I lived every single day. And for some reason or another, I set everything down and I threw my hands in the air. I said, please, God, please, don't let me live another day like this. And I have been clean and sober since that day. By God's loving grace. Absolutely by God's loving grace. Now, when I got out of treatment, I went to treatment the very next day again, back in Albuquerque, State Hospital. I got out, and I walked straight into the AA house that was there. And there was a guy who had watched me for 5 years come in and cry and whine about my wife and da-da-da-da-da. His name was Ken C. And I said, Ken, I need a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? He said, hell no. No way, man. I've watched you for 5 years come in here and cry and whine like a little baby, and I don't want, no. And I said, Ken, I understand. But I told him, I'll do anything you tell me. I will do anything. I don't want to live like this. I'll do anything you tell me. He said, okay, you will. But the day you don't, Joe, the day you balk, the day you say, no, I can't do that or whatever, then you call me with the name of your new sponsor. Now, I have this little deal that, just, you know, we'll appoint a temporary sponsor for you. Don't cut it with me. You know, it's like, it was everything in my being to be able to walk up to that man, to walk up, suck up, take all that and say, I need help. Will you be my sponsor? Because I don't want anybody to miss that opportunity. He said yes, and exactly what he did is he said, Joe, it's not going to be my ego. It's not going to be your ego. We're going to work the steps exactly like the first 164 pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous say so. That way there's no argument. And that's exactly what he did. And we walked through, took me through the first step, took me through the second step, took me through the third step. He took me through the fourth step. Now in this time, well, let me step back. That was on a Sunday that I got out of treatment. On Monday, that Monday, I went to a Monday night men's stag meeting. Now Ken told me, he said, Joe, the first thing I want you to do is go read the doctor's opinion. I want you to go to meetings and not drink in between. And I said, okay. So I went to a meeting in the morning on that Monday at noon at 5:30, and then I went at 8 o'clock. I went to the Monday night men's stag meeting. I walked in there, and the topic was hitting bottom. And there was a guy sitting, the room was set up just like it is right here. And it started, and I was about the second or third person that it came to. And it got to me, and I said, oh, hitting bottom. Gentlemen, kick back and listen. I'm 25 years old. I've lost two wives, two kids, wrecked everything, wrecked cars, beat this, beat that, did this, did that. And this little guy comes running across the room. This guy's a little Mexican guy, Skid Row wino, had been on Skid Row for 28 years. He reaches in his eye, pops his glass eye out of his head, stuffs it in my face, and said, shut up, little boy. When you lose your eye for a bottle of beer, they don't want to hear your shit. He says, so look at this. Look at this. He said, you see this? My fingers are gone in the street. I don't even know where they're at, and I don't even know how. He says, you come in here crying about your little wife. I don't want to hear it. Then he pulled his shirt off, and he showed me scar on top of scar on top of scar. 28 years I live on Skid Row. 28 years. You ain't lost nothing. Nothing. Shut up. I stepped back, I sat down, and I became teachable for the first time in my life. Now, Roger, his name was Roger, and he became one of my sponsors. And they tell me Roger's drunk again. But he saved my life. And Ken helped me work through those steps. We got through the fourth step. He said, you got 7 days, Joe. We did the third step. He said, you got 7 days to do this fourth step. 7 days? I'm not ready, Ken. He said, oh, you got the name of a new sponsor? Oh, no, I'll do it. And I believe it says somewhere right in here that if not, though a crucial and vital step, unless I not follow that once, then it had little permanent effect. And he showed me where it said that, and that's exactly what I did. He said, now I want you to be thinking about who you're going to do your fifth step with, and I knew I would do it with Roger. And I went, and the first step, we got there, I went, I did my fourth step, and I got there with Roger, and we sat down, and Roger said, okay, we're going to go over the steps, Joe. He said, we're going to go through each one of them one more time to make sure you're ready. Okay, Roger. And he said, the first step, he says like this. He said, in the morning, he says, you know, I get up and I make me some coffee. As I make me some coffee, it's about 6:15 in the morning. He says, the birds are singing, the sun's coming up over the mountains. It's beautiful. I get on my knees. I thank God I'm sober. It's beautiful. He says, it's just me and God. I'm drinking my coffee. I feel good. Joe. I feel good inside. He said, I look at my watch. It's about 6:30. Oh, my God. I'm going to explode. I feel so good. About 6:45, my damn wife wakes up. You see, the first step, and I understood what he meant, because you see, as long as it's just me and my ego, I'm okay. And I can be powerless, because it's just me absorbing the things that I want. But if invite one unmanageable event, one thing that I cannot control outside of me, and it all goes away. It all goes away. So what's the answer? Well, the answer is that I have to believe in a power greater than myself. Now, there was another guy who was in my life at that time. His name was Don. And Don was a little tunnel rat. He did four tours in Vietnam, and he helped me tremendously. And he'd helped me with a second step because, see, I couldn't get by the insane thing. I'm not insane, not an intellect like me. You know, I just could not comprehend that I had that kind of a problem. Now, I could believe in a power greater than myself, but it was the Catholic God. And everything I did was wrong. I mean, I had to repent for it, and I had to get on my knees and say 25 Hail Marys. And if I didn't, then I was in trouble. You know, and I couldn't figure how come when I go and I do the 25 Hail Marys, do I still feel the same way? I couldn't understand that. So he said, Joe, it's because you believe, but you don't believe that God will and can restore you to sanity. Well, what's sanity? So he took this piece of paper, he drew a line down it, and he said, God is on this side and God is not. He said, I want you to define what God is. And so I put, God is love, unconditional love. He said, yeah, that's right. That's as good a definition as I've ever heard. But it's your definition, and that's all that matters. He said, so what is God not? And I said, God is not vengeful, and he's not out to get me, and he's not going to hurt me, and he doesn't want to do this, and he's not going to do that. He's good. Good, good. So he took the piece of paper, he ripped, wadded up the God is not, threw it away, and he said, no longer is God that. God is love for you. Now you pray to that. So I shared that with Roger when I was doing my fifth step. We got through that and got to the third step. And we went through, we talked about how that third step, and see, for me, I used to think for some reason that the third step meant that I am now saying to you, the general population, that when I leave here, I'm going to be standing on the corner with a tambourine and a robe and a little sign, bouncing with a bald head, you know. That's what I thought that meant, that I had to go from this extreme to that extreme. He said, no. No, that's not it at all. He said, it's just about making a decision. See, I see people in the program all the time, guys I sponsor. They're trying. Well, I'm trying to turn my life and will over to the care of God. Now, there is no try, man. It's just make a decision. Indecision is the worst place an alcoholic can be. Confusion sets you out there thinking, oh, my God. You know, just make a decision and move forward. That's what the third step means to me. So he showed me that. We went through the fourth step. I'm sitting with Roger. He's talking about, see, it's a decision. You made it. It's good. So we start on this fifth step. Listed my resentments, and I went. He said, okay, go to the first one. I resent this. Cause. What's the cause? Well, they did this. Da, da, da. Okay. He said, now, where are you? And then it says, what does it affect? Oh, it affects my ambition and my self-esteem and my sex life. Oh, okay. Okay, now the fourth cause. Where are you at fault? I looked at him myself. I was wondering what that fourth column was for. See, where are you at fault? He said, look in the book. It says right here, now we were ready to look at the book, look at the problem from an entirely different angle. We looked at it, where was I selfish, self-centered, da, 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 da. He said, selfishness, self-centeredness, see right here. I said, oh, yeah. So where were you at fault? He said, look here, look. He said, selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root. That's the root of all our troubles. Driven by hundreds of forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation. He says, that's the root, Joe. The root. He said, if you have a pecan tree and it grows pecans, he said, what does it grow? And I said, well, pecans. Good, good, that's good. He said, well, it's not that hard, man. I mean, pecans grow pecans. That's right, that's right. He said, but a pecan tree cannot grow peaches. Right. He said, for a pecan tree to grow peaches, it would take an act of God. Only a miracle could make a pecan tree grow peaches. Yeah. And you, your root is selfishness and self-centeredness. And you are a tree of selfishness and self-centeredness. He said, and the only fruit you know how to bear is selfish and self-centered. And the only way to make that go away is a miracle. And it will take God. Nothing you can do. So our basic trouble, you know, it says, is that the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. And the only way to get rid of self, or what does it say, is that we must be rid of self, we must, or it kills us. And the only way to make that possible, God makes that possible. You see, unmanageability, when we go back to that first step for me, means that I don't have the ability to make myself sober. I don't care how hard I work these steps, I cannot expect to stay sober because of what I do. I stay sober because of a loving God and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous who help me remove those things that stand in the way of me and him. And selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of those things that stand in the way of me and my God. And Roger helped me, and we go through, and we say, okay, what's the next one? What's the next one? Oh, this is the cause. This is it. And what is the effect? Those effects, this, that, that. He said, were you at fault? I said, selfish, self-centered. That's right. And I swear to you, as the honest to God truth, he had a Big Chief tablet and one of those Husky pencils. And he would, as I would go through, he said, that's right, selfish and self-centeredness. He said, that's it. And then he would write on the tablet, I-G-O. That's your ego. That's your ego. 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 So we go to the next one. You know, what's that? Ego. 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 So we were finished with the step, and he said, I'm saying, I thought I was supposed to feel good when I finished this step. He said, what did you learn? I said that I'm selfish and self-centered and egotistical, that I want things my way, and if I don't have them my way, I cry like a baby, that I always think I can manage to get what I want. He said, that's right. You are. You're selfish, you're self-centered, you're egotistical, you're maniacal, all that stuff that you said. But let me tell you one thing, Nico. He said, let me tell you one thing right now. You're egotistical, you're selfish, you're self-centered, you want everything your way, but you are a child of God, and God don't make trash. And for the first time in my life, somebody took me from this level down here and took me off of this level up here and made me just one up. No better, no less, just one up. He said, you see, these things that we've talked about are the things that stand in the way of you and God. He said, let me tell you, he says, it's like this. And he walked over to his front door. He walked over to his front door, and there's this little apartment that he lived in. The shades were all drawn. He turned off the light. And there was all kinds of furniture in the middle. And so he walked over, and he hid all this stuff. He walked in, oh, that hurts. He said, oh, my God, I hid everything over here. Nothing there. Oh, my God, that hurts me. And I said, well, yeah, man, the lights are off, and you got one eye. He said, I know, I can't see. He says, you see, when I go through my life with no light, when I go through my life with no light, and I just try to go on and stumbling, I trip over things, I step on the toes of the fellows, and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. But when I go back, and I stand by the door, and I look, and I do nothing,
He says, sometimes the hardest thing in the world for you to do, Joe, is going to be to do nothing. And just look in my one eye, just the one eye can look and I see, and it starts to light up the room. And I don't see completely clearly, but I can see there's a table. And I walk around the table. And I walk over here and I see the chair. And then I walk up to the lamp and I turn the lamp on and the light comes and it fills the room and I don't stumble over nothing and I don't hit nothing. He said, when you go from here now, you know you're selfish and self-centered. You know the root of your trouble. When you go from here, you're going to mess up good. Every time you mess up from this point forward, you're going to mess up good. And I understood what he meant. And for the first time, I walked free. He said, now go home and read and do what it says in the fifth step. Now, this is all within the first, this is like in the second week I was out of treatment. You know, for you for the people who think, oh, I'm not ready. I don't know if I was ready or not either, but I know that happened and I know I'm still sober today because they work these steps the way it said in the book. If not followed at once, if not followed at once, if not followed at once, da-da-da-da-da. And he said, go home and sit quietly for an hour, take down the book, ask yourself if you skimped on the cement, if you made sand, cement without sand, you know. And I read that, and I read that paragraph, and something jumped out at me. You see, I had been approaching this Alcoholics Anonymous thing to think that once I got myself all figured out, that I would, you know, we're all in search of, well, I just got to get to know myself better, you know. Yeah, that's what I need. It had nothing to do with knowing me better. When I read that, it said, if we can answer satisfactorily, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. And now those things don't stand in the way of my relationship with him. All that stuff that I thought I was guilty for, that I thought that I was such a bad person for, no longer stood in the way. Chuck Chamberlain says, he says, the only thing that stands between me and you is me. And the only thing that stands between me and God is me. And the only thing that stands between me and me is me. And now, when all that was gone, nothing stood between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. And I was rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. Now, I read on, he said, you go, you read the sixth step, you read the seventh step. The step that separates the men from the boys, I believe the 12 and 12 says. I thought for the longest time that step six and seven meant that now, you know, every time I saw a pretty girl, I had to hit myself. Oh, don't look at her, you're lusting again. Oh, no, 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 oh my God. I thought that every time I saw something nice and I got, you know, felt greed. Oh my God, get on my knees and do that deal, you know. I thought that that's what those steps said, but that's not what they say. They said that we're just ready for God to remove all of our defects of character. And if you read the seventh step, and I wish I would have done this right away, and I didn't. I'll be the first to tell you, this sobriety deal has been a progression. But what happened for me was, is that I read that seven-step prayer one day, and it said, my Creator, I'm now ready that you should have all of me. Good and bad. Remove the defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness to you. You see, it's selfish for me to stand here today. And I don't believe that lust is the root as one of my seven deadly sins. And I don't believe that I have these character defects that you could list one right after the other. Roger told me I have two. I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. And I want God to remove those things from me. And when I do that, I don't have to go about trying to fix myself. You see, you can't cure an alcoholic mind with an alcoholic mind. And that's what I was trying to do. I went on. We went through the eighth step. We took another look back at it. I looked at the eighth step and then got to the ninth step. The parents of a little girl named Ashley, go to the children's room, please. Oh, now I've got to start all over. When I got to the eighth step, I owed a lot of people. There was a guy
My brother and a friend of his had gone out hunting. And I was living in a little trailer, and this was somewhere back in that drinking time. And they had gone out hunting. They came back to this little trailer of mine, and they left these shotguns. Well, this friend of my brother's had borrowed a shotgun and left it there. And I had a date that night, but no money. So I was in a dilemma. So I figured I would just borrow the shotgun long enough to borrow about $65-$70 on it, and then get the money back and get it, and no problem, you know. Well, that's the way I always seem to think, you know, that I'll get the money right away and I'll get it back. And I don't think I ever got anything out of Hawk, to be honest with you. And this was a Beretta over and under, gold-plated, limited edition, engraved 12-gauge shotgun. If anybody knows what a shotgun I'm talking about, I mean, we're talking sweet gun. And I got about $60 for it. And I went out, and I partied with that girl, and there was another date, something else I had to sell, and I never got the money for it, and I left it in there. Well, this guy, this friend of my brother's, told the owner what I had done. So I had to make sure I wasn't where he was at any given time. You know, and you just don't, you got this kind of a lot of fear riding on your back when you're doing that. Like, oh my God, if Tom sees me, what in the world's going to happen? And I was at a meeting one day, and I had been going about making amends. Done the 8-step, and my sponsors had told me that making amends, Joe, isn't about going back to people and telling them how sorry you are. They know that already. Making amends means to fix, to make right the wrongs that you did. If you owe people, you pay them. And I said, okay, yeah. And so I had gone about making the little amends, you know, here and there, and I was starting to have those 9-step promises. And I was at a meeting one day, and there was this guy, Alan. And Alan says, you know, the topic was the 9-step. He says, if you're drunk and you steal horses, you're a drunk horse thief. If you sober up, you're still a horse thief. Until you take the horses back. You see, I can't go on living with somebody else's horse in my corral. I got to feed it. I got to water it. I got to brush it down. I got to do all those things. And usually I'm not real good at that kind of responsibility. So I end up just leaving it be. And it ends up dying back there. And I got this stinky, smelly carcass following me around everywhere I go. Only it just looks like a 12-gauge shotgun. So I went to this guy and I said, yeah, you know what I did? I took your gun. I sold it. I was wrong. I'm only out of treatment a month or so, and I was wrong, and I'm willing to pay you back. And he just was floored. I can't believe you're actually coming to do this. I said, if I don't, I'll drink again, and I don't want to drink. I'll pay you $25 a week. And I paid him $25 a week. And little by little, I don't know, 5-6 years sober, you know, I'm buying new cars, and we own our own home, and just all the things that I owed are just not there anymore. And I look back and I think, how? Well, it says it, Joe. If we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We'll know a new freedom. You know, we'll have all these things. Fear of financial economic insecurity will leave us. Fear of people will leave us. We won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. All those things had come true for me. The 10th step, and I'm ready to, I promise, we've still got, 2 or 3 hours. The 10th step for me is just a recap of taking a look back every day of where I'm at. Have I hurt somebody? Was I selfish and self-centered again? Did I do something to make somebody wrong? You know, do I got to go back and admit I was wrong? When I do that, I don't live with that in my, I don't put another horse in that corral. And it gives me the freedom to be able to walk through on a daily basis. The 11th step, for some reason or another, you know, I go back to that orange robe and the shaved head. I thought, you know, of course, me thinking, that The 11th step meant that I had to learn yoga, you know, that I had to go into meditation, that I had to just kind of so that I could hear God. And my sponsor said, no, no, Joe, you got this all wrong. He says, you see, it's prayer. Prayer is talking to God. Meditation is listening to God. So you listen to God all day. You ask Him. You take Him with you everywhere you go. He says, you go in a room and you sit for half an hour. You talk to God for half an hour. What do you do for the 23 and a half hours later? Good point. He says, you constantly ask God to help you do the thing, the next right thing. It's not about you thinking about what you're supposed to do. You couldn't do it if you wanted to. You can't manage. You are unmanageable. And I understood what he said. Which brings me to the 12th step. The 12th step is about what I'm doing standing here right now. 11 and a half years ago, I lived in the back of a car. In 1986, I made $2,683.68 on 9 different jobs. I calculated how much I spent on drinking and drugs, and I spent somewhere in excess of $30,000. Now, I don't know, but it doesn't take a real genius to realize that you can't live that kind of a way, you know, and not owe somebody. Yet, here I sit, and here I stand to share my message with you to say that if you think for one second that this program can't work for you, then take a look. There's a guy outside a minute ago telling me, man, that's a nice suit. And I said, and at first I was taken aback, and I thought, yeah, it is. It is, thanks to God. I remember the days when I would pick through piles and smell, you know. That one's too bad, you know. Oh, yeah, this one will work. Pull that underwear. And I don't live like that today. You see, the 12th step to me means that one day, whenever I make it to the big meeting, you know, God's going to take me and He's going to set me on His lap. And He's going to run this big screen TV and He's going to run a tape. And He's going to say, you know, you were in Tuscaloosa, Alabama on August 29th. And there was this group of people, and there was a guy you never talked to, you never saw him, you never met him. Let me show you what he was going to do that night. He's going to run that tape. And he's going to say, that guy was going to go home that night and pull the plug. But he heard me through you, Joe. He heard me through you that night. And let me show you now, on fast forward, what happened. He made it to a meeting the next day. And the next day. And he didn't abuse his wife anymore. And he didn't do this anymore. He became a loving father to his children. You see, I know that because I sit tonight with my beautiful wife. I'm stepfather to 3 daughters. Just Wednesday, the oldest daughter came to me with her baby. She's 24 years old, and she brings her little 3-month-old daughter to me, my little granddaughter. I just wanted to say thank you. If you're a drunk like me who hated yourself, who wanted to die more than you wanted anything, and can stand here today and say, by God's loving grace, just take it one day at a time, one day at a time. Keep coming back no matter what. I don't care whether you drink or not. Just keep coming back. Then my life has value. My life isn't that trash that I thought I was. I'm God's perfect, precious little baby, just like every one of you in this room and every one out there that hasn't made it here yet. All I got to do is act like God's precious, perfect little baby. Thank you for letting me be here one more time.